Hello, and welcome to The Big Snore. In each episode, I will read a passage from a book, an article, a magazine that runs about 15 to 20 minutes. You can choose to listen to this as a bedtime story or just a story at any time of the day. Today, the passage I'm reading is from The Body Keeps the Score by Bessel van der Kolk. In the early 1980s, my colleague, Carlin Leons Ruth, a Harvard attachment researcher, began to videotape face-to-face interactions between mothers and their infants at 6 months, 12 months, and 18 months. She taped them again when the children were 5 years old, and once more when they were 7 or 8. All were from high-risk families, 100% met federal poverty guidelines, and almost half the mothers were single parents. Disorganized attachment showed up in two different ways. One group of mothers seemed to be too preoccupied with their own issues to attend to their infants. They were often intrusive and hostile. They alternated between rejecting their infants and acting as if they expected them to respond to their needs. Another group of mothers seemed helpless and fearful. They often came across as sweet or fragile, but they didn't know how to be the adult in the relationship and seemed to want their children to comfort them. They failed to greet their children after having been away and did not pick them up when the children were distressed. The mothers didn't seem to be doing these things deliberately. They simply didn't know how to be attuned to their kids and respond to their cues, and thus failed to comfort and reassure them. The hostile, intrusive mothers were more likely to have childhood histories of physical abuse and/or of witnessing domestic violence, while the withdrawn, dependent mothers were more likely to have histories of sexual abuse or parental loss, but not physical abuse. I have always wondered how parents come to abuse their kids. After all, raising healthy offspring is at the very core of our human sense of purpose and meaning. What could drive parents to deliberately hurt or neglect their children? Carlin's research provided me with one answer. Watching her videos, I could see the children becoming more and more inconsolable, sullen, or resistant to their misattuned mothers. At the same time, the mothers became increasingly frustrated, defeated, and helpless in their interactions. Once the mother comes to see the child not as her partner in an attuned relationship, but as a frustrating and raging, disconnected stranger, the stage is set for subsequent abuse. About 18 years later, when these kids were around 20 years old, Leons Ruth did a follow-up study to see how they were coping. Infants with seriously disrupted emotional communication patterns with their mothers at 18 months grew up to become young adults with an unstable sense of self. Self-damaging impulsivity, including excessive spending, promiscuous sex, substance abuse, reckless driving, and binge eating, inappropriate and intense anger, and recurrent suicidal behavior. Carlin and her colleagues had expected that hostile, intrusive behavior on the part of the mothers would be the most powerful predictor of mental instability in their adult children. But they discovered otherwise. Emotional withdrawal had the most profound and long-lasting impact. Emotional distance and role reversal, in which mothers expected the kids to look after them, were specifically linked to aggressive behavior against self and others in the young adults. Leons Ruth was particularly interested in the phenomenon of dissociation, which is manifested in feeling lost, overwhelmed, abandoned, and disconnected from the world, and in seeing oneself as unloved, empty, helpless, trapped, and weighed down. She found a striking and unexpected relationship between maternal disengagement and misattunement during the first 2 years of life and dissociative symptoms in early adulthood. Leons Ruth concludes that infants who are not truly seen and known by their mothers are at high risk to grow into adolescents who are unable to know and to see. Infants who live in secure relationships learn to communicate not only their frustrations and distress, but also their emerging selves, their interests, preferences, and goals. Receiving a sympathetic response, cushions infants and adults against extreme levels of frightened arousal. But if your caregivers ignore your needs or resent your very existence, you learn to anticipate rejection and withdrawal. You cope as well as you can by blocking out your mother's hostility or neglect and act as if it doesn't matter. But your body is likely to remain in a state of high alert, prepared to ward off blows, deprivation, or abandonment. Dissociation means simultaneously knowing and not knowing. Bowlby wrote, "What cannot be communicated to the mother cannot be communicated to the self." If you cannot tolerate what you know or feel what you feel, the only option is denial and dissociation. Maybe the most devastating long-term effect of this shutdown is not feeling real inside, a condition we saw in the kids in the children's clinic, and that we see in the children and adults who come to the trauma center. When you don't feel real, nothing matters, which makes it impossible to protect yourself from danger. Or you may resort to extremes in an effort to feel something, even cutting yourself with a razor blade or getting into fistfights with strangers. Carlin's research showed that dissociation is learned early. Later, abuse or other traumas did not account for dissociative symptoms in young adults. Abuse and trauma accounted for many other problems, but not for chronic dissociation or aggression against self. The critical underlying issue was that these patients didn't know how to feel safe. Lack of safety within the early caregiving relationship led to an impaired sense of inner reality, excessive clinging, and self-damaging behavior. Poverty, single parenthood, or maternal psychiatric symptoms did not predict these symptoms. This does not imply that child abuse is irrelevant, but that the quality of early caregiving is critically important in preventing mental health problems, independent of other traumas. For that reason, treatment needs to address not only the imprints of specific traumatic events, but also the consequences of not having been mirrored, attuned to, and given consistent care and affection. Dissociation and loss of self-regulation. Early attachment patterns create the inner maps that chart our relationships throughout life, not only in terms of what we expect from others, but also in terms of how much comfort and pleasure we can experience in their presence. I doubt that the poet E.E. Cummings could have written his joyous lines, "I like my body when it is with your body, muscles better and nerves more," if his earliest experiences had been frozen faces and hostile glances. Our relationship maps are implicit, etched into the emotional brain, and not reversible simply by understanding how they were created. You may realize that your fear of intimacy has something to do with your mother's postpartum depression, or with the fact that she herself was molested as a child, but that alone is unlikely to open you to happy, trusting engagement with others. However, that realization may help you to start exploring other ways to connect in relationships, both for your own sake and in order to not pass on an insecure attachment to your own children. In part 5, I'll discuss a number of approaches to healing damaged attunement systems through training in rhythmicity and reciprocity. Being in sync with oneself and with others requires the integration of our body-based senses, vision, hearing, touch, and balance. If this did not happen in infancy and early childhood, there's an increased chance of later sensory integration problems, to which trauma and neglect are by no means the only pathways. Being in sync means resonating through sounds and movements that connect, which are embedded in the daily sensory rhythms of cooking and cleaning, going to bed and waking up. Being in sync may mean sharing funny faces and hugs, expressing delight or disapproval at the right moments, tossing balls back and forth, or singing together. At the trauma center, we have developed programs to coach parents in connection and attunement, and my patients have told me about many other ways to get themselves in sync. ranging from choral singing and ballroom dancing to joining basketball teams, jazz bands, and chamber music groups. All of these foster a sense of attunement and communal pleasure. Trapped in relationships, the cost of abuse and neglect. The Night Sea journey is a journey into the parts of ourselves that are split off, disavowed, unknown, unwanted, cast out, and exiled to the various subterranean worlds of consciousness. The goal of this journey is to reunite us with ourselves. Such a homecoming can be surprisingly painful, even brutal. In order to undertake it, we must first agree to exile nothing, says Stephen Cope. Marilyn was a tall, athletic-looking woman in her mid-30s who worked as an operating room nurse in a nearby town. She told me that a few months earlier she'd started to play tennis at her sports club with a Boston fireman named Michael. She usually steered clear of men, she said, but she had gradually become comfortable enough with Michael to accept his invitations to go out for pizza after their matches. They'd talk about tennis, movies, their nephews and nieces, nothing too personal. Michael clearly enjoyed her company, but she told herself he didn't really know her. One Saturday evening in August, after tennis and pizza, she invited him to stay over at her apartment. She described feeling uptight and unreal as soon as they were alone together. She remembered asking him to go slow, but had very little sense of what had happened after that. After a few glasses of wine and a rerun of Law & Order, they apparently fell asleep together on top of her bed. At around 2 in the morning, Michael turned over in his sleep. When Marilyn felt his body touch hers, she exploded, pounding him with her fists, scratching and biting, screaming, "You bastard! You bastard!" Michael, startled awake, grabbed his belongings and fled. After he left, Marilyn sat on her bed for hours, stunned by what had happened. She felt deeply humiliated and hated herself for what she'd done. And now she'd come to me for help in dealing with her terror of men and her inexplicable rage attacks. My work with veterans had prepared me to listen to painful stories like Marilyn's without trying to jump in immediately to fix the problem. Therapy often starts with some inexplicable behavior: attacking a boyfriend in the middle of the night, feeling terrified when somebody looks you in the eye, finding yourself covered with blood after cutting yourself with a piece of glass, or deliberately vomiting up every meal. It takes time and patience to allow the reality behind such symptoms to reveal itself. As we talked, Marilyn told me that Michael was the first man she'd taken home in more than 5 years. But this was not the first time she'd lost control when a man spent the night with her. She repeated that she always felt uptight and spaced out when she was alone with a man, and there had been other times when she'd come to in her apartment, cowering in a corner, unable to remember clearly what had happened. Marilyn also said she felt as if she was just going through the motions of having a life, except for when she was at the club, playing tennis, or at work in the operating room. She usually felt numb. A few years earlier, she'd found that she could relieve her numbness by scratching herself with a razor blade. But she'd become frightened when she found that she was cutting herself more and more deeply, and more often, to get relief. She had tried alcohol, too, but that reminded her of her dad and his out-of-control drinking, which made her feel disgusted with herself. So instead, she played tennis fanatically, whenever she could. That made her feel alive. When I asked her about her past, Marilyn said she guessed that she must have had a happy childhood, but she could remember very little from before age 12. She told me she'd been a timid adolescent until she had a violent confrontation with her alcoholic father when she was 16 and ran away from home. She worked her way through community college and went on to get a degree in nursing without any help from her parents. She felt ashamed that during this time she'd slept around, which she described as looking for love in all the wrong places. As I often did with new patients, I asked her to draw a family portrait. And when I saw her drawing, I decided to go slowly. Clearly, Marilyn was harboring some terrible memories, but she could not allow herself to recognize what her own picture revealed. She had drawn a wild and terrified child, trapped in some kind of cage, and threatened not only by three nightmarish figures, one with no eyes, but also by a huge erect penis protruding into her space. And yet, this woman said she must have had a happy childhood. As the poet W. H. Auden wrote, "Truth, like love and sleep, resents approaches that are too intense." I call this Auden's rule, and in keeping with it, I deliberately did not push Marilyn to tell me what she remembered. In fact, I've learned that it's not important for me to know every detail of a patient's trauma. What is critical is that the patients themselves learn to tolerate feeling what they feel and knowing what they know. This may take weeks or even years. I decided to start Marilyn's treatment by inviting her to join an established therapy group where she could find support and acceptance before facing the engine of her distrust, shame, and rage. As I expected, Marilyn arrived at the first group meeting looking terrified, much like the girl in her family portrait. She was withdrawn and did not reach out to anybody. I'd chosen this group for her because its members had always been helpful and accepting of new members who were too scared to talk. They knew from their own experience that unlocking secrets is a gradual process, but this time they surprised me, asking so many intrusive questions about Marilyn's love life that I recalled her drawing of the little girl under assault. It was almost as though Marilyn had unwittingly enlisted the group to repeat her traumatic past. I intervened to help her set some boundaries about what she'd talk about, and she began to settle in. 3 months later, Marilyn told the group that she had stumbled and fallen a few times on the sidewalk between the subway and my office. She worried that her eyesight was beginning to fail. She'd also been missing a lot of tennis balls recently. I thought again about her drawing and the wild child with the huge, terrified eyes. Was this some sort of conversion reaction, in which patients express their conflicts by losing function in some part of their body? Many soldiers in both world wars had suffered paralysis that couldn't be traced to physical injuries, and I had seen cases of hysterical blindness in Mexico and India. Still, as a physician, I wasn't about to conclude without further assessment that this was all in her head. I referred her to colleagues at the Massachusetts Eye and Ear Infirmary and asked them to do a very thorough workup. Several weeks later, the tests came back. Marilyn had lupus erythematosus in her retina, an autoimmune disease that was eroding her vision, and she would need immediate treatment. I was appalled. Marilyn was the third person that year whom I'd suspected of having an incest history, and who was then diagnosed with an autoimmune disease, a disease in which the body starts attacking itself. After making sure that Marilyn was getting the proper medical care, I consulted with two of my colleagues at Massachusetts General, a psychiatrist, Scott Wilson, and Richard Creighton, who ran the immunology lab there. I told them Marilyn's story, showed them the picture she'd drawn, and asked them to collaborate on a study. They generously volunteered their time and the considerable expense of a full immunology workup. We recruited 12 women with incest histories who were not taking any medications, plus 12 women who'd never been traumatized and who also did not take meds, a surprisingly difficult control group to find. Marilyn was not in the study. We generally do not ask our clinical patients to be part of our research efforts. That was a passage from Bessel van der Kolk's book, The Body Keeps the Score. You are listening to The Big Snore. Until next time.